public finances and society. Listen to Jacques de la Rosière, member of the French Academy des Sciences Morales et Politiques.
I shall make a few remarks on the recent history of globalization. We all live in a globalizing world, and we sometimes forget that the world we had between, let's say, 1850 and 1914 was also very intensely integrated. And that was true for capital movements, trade, immigration, information. If you look, for instance, at the stock of foreign capital related to the GDP of the developing countries in 1914, you see that the figure was some 30%, whilst the figure today is only 20%. It's also true for immigration. Immigration was very substantial. For instance, 9 million immigrants to the United States during the decade 1900-1910, against something like 7 million today. And the trade integration, although it was less advanced in terms of exports to GDP than it is today, was extremely significant. And this was all the more important that there was one international currency at the time, which was the gold standard, which we, of course, don't have today, where national currencies fluctuate, float, but in some respects don't really float. But this economy of the 19th century and the early 20th century also created tensions and difficulties which are very comparable to the ones we know today. For instance, the European agriculture, which was facing imports at very low prices, coming in particular from America, Australia, Canada, etc., had to face very deep crises, which have led to rural immigration and in some cases, great poverty. One can also say that the importation of goods produced at very low cost by developing countries in advanced countries has led to very strong oppositions to globalization at the time. You had protectionist tendencies in the United Kingdom, also in France, very much so in the agricultural sector. You also had periods of tension in the United States. For instance, the abandonment of the gold standard from 1862 to 1879, and the anti-immigration sentiment was rather generally felt. Now, it remains nonetheless that those sort of 65 years have been extremely beneficial to the general economic situation of the world. The world knew at that time, experienced at that time, the highest growth rate that it ever did. And this allowed some countries like Canada, Australia, countries in Latin America to catch up in terms of standards of living, the most prosperous countries of the so-called West. Some of these countries, very poor in, let's say, the 1870s, had even outperformed some European Western countries in 1900. And although colonization was the name of the day in Africa, Africa knew an important development at the time. In spite of these successes, this globalized world fell apart in a few weeks in a very brutal fashion in 1914. And I was interested to read an American economist called Jeffrey Friedan in a little book he just wrote on Will Capitalism Fall Again in the Bruegel essay and lecture series. I was interested to read his reflections on the causes of this dismantling and the fact that economic nationalism prevailed after the war during the two decades before the Second World War. One tried, nonetheless, to rebuild after 1920 a international system. But in fact, it didn't work out. there was a set of tensions in terms of access to raw materials. There were competitive devaluations, beggar thy neighbor policies. And in spite of all the attempts with conferences and institutions, never was it possible to recreate a global system. That was not because of technical or technological, I would say, insufficiencies. Actually, inventions and innovations were the name of the day. And the mass production, if you look at the Charlie Chaplin film on the modern life, was actually the way the more and more internationalized firms operated. So what were the causes of this impossibility of reconstructing an international system? Well, of course, there are many causes. The measures of reparations that were asked from Germany, well, of course, one of the facts that ended the economic collaboration between France and Germany, which had been one of the pillars of the economic Europe before 1914. Also, the loss of the American leadership after 1920 had weakened the system. But the fundamental cause of this incapability of restoring a global system was really a political cause. If you look at the period 1850-1914, you see that the governing circles of the great nations were convinced that the international order was globally beneficial to the populations and that it was the duty of national economies, in a way, to adjust to international constraints because of the international competition that pervaded. And those circles did not believe that it was for the international system to adapt to the national problems. And this meant, and this is very fundamental in the understanding of what happened, that the political elites accepted the notion that prices and wages, in case of tension, could diminish, could be lower for some countries in order to allow competition to prevail. Now, in the 19th century, where production was, in a way, the result of small enterprises where the, I would say, the trade unions were quasi-inexistent, there was a great flexibility in the formation of prices and salaries. And one can add that at the time, democracy, as we experience it now, was less advanced than it is today, and that the systems of government were perhaps more elitist, as we say, and less sensitive to public opinion. But after the 1914 war, these basic conditions have changed. Large firms were becoming more and more concentrated with monopolistic or oligopolistic powers in terms of price formation. Trade unions developed and reinforced. Agrarian parties formed, and governments started to legislate much more than they did before in terms of social matters, welfare state. They also indulged into inflation and budgetary deficits. All these factors contributed to make prices and salaries more rigid and therefore less adjustable to international constraints than they were before. So the real question was posed, how could we make a international system founded on capitalism and comparative advantages, how could we make that system work in a world where companies, trade unions, and states were more and more interventionist? So in a way, that was the basic question. After the Second World War, the Bretton Woods system has tried to rebuild a certain order, international order, based on gradual liberalization of international trade, the abandonment of competitive devaluations under the authority of the IMF, and that system worked rather well in spite of the end of the fixed exchange rate in 1971. Then the deregulation of the 80s and the Thatcherian reaction against the excesses of state interventionism have led to a new phase of globalization, the one we know today. And I could add that the end of the planified Soviet system of economies in 1989 accelerated the process, and now China and India are integrated in the world system. But new signs of discontent and tensions are rebuilding. And, with the what we call in France delocalization, that is outsourcing, with the loss of employment, that is to some extent the result of globalization. And the question is this one: will political factors, those very factors which were at the source of the dismantling of what they call now the first globalization, will those political factors play anew? And that would be, of course, manifest if countries like the United States or Europe were to go back to protectionism. It seems to me that two fundamental conditions should be met in order to avoid this protectionist temptation. First of all, a firmer and more objective governance of multilateral institutions that are in charge of this famous world order, notably regarding the question of the discipline of exchange rates, the respect of industrial property, and also international actions to reduce CO2 emissions in order to answer the question of the dangers of the heating of the planet, one of the undesirable effects of globalization, and also taking necessary measures to buffer the shocks of globalization, and I think in particular of favoring education, research, development, innovation, which are, at the bottom line, the true means to face international competition.